It is Monday, July the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Greeks reject the EU bailout offer by a wide margin.
As a Greek, I feel very proud that people did not have fear. They voted with their hearts.
Also ahead, working for an agreement on Iran's nuclear agenda, plus the U.S. women's soccer team taking the world title. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Greeks have voted against accepting a bailout from the European Union in return for more spending cuts. Early results suggest the no camp won with around 61% of the vote. Henry Ridgewell reporting now from Athens.
By sunset, Syntagma Square outside Parliament was filling with jubilant Greeks. Polls had suggested a tight result. In the end, Greece, by a wide margin, rejected Europe's offer of a bailout in return for more austerity. Athens pensioner Nikos Minas said Greeks had defied the warnings from Brussels. He said, as a Greek, I feel very proud that people did not have fear. They voted with their hearts. Henry Ridgewell, Athens.
Number of media reporting that with the no vote in Greece, the country is moving into what they called uncharted territory. For some perspective on all of this and what it means, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Shane Oliver. He's the chief economist and head of investment strategy at AMP Capital in Sydney. Oliver said he was somewhat surprised by the extent of the no vote.
The polls coming into the votes were pretty close, and so I thought there would have been a closer result, and I thought some of the undecideds would go in favour of the yes vote, given the turmoil that the Greek banking system was going through. So it is a bit of a surprising vote, and it's certainly the case that Greece has lurched into uncharted territory.
The head of the Eurofinance Ministers, the Eurogroup, Mr. Dijsselbloem of Netherlands, said the no vote is very regrettable. I take note of the outcome, the result regrettable for the future of Greece. What does he mean?
I think basically what he's saying is that the no vote has led to intense uncertainty regarding Greece. The banking system will probably get a lot worse before it gets better. And although there's nothing in the euro area rules to say that a country that's in default, as Greece now is, needs to leave the euro, the odds are that Greece probably will end up leaving the euro simply because it won't have enough money to pay its make its government payments, to support its banking system. It's really going to need its own currency because the ECB, the support of the European Central Bank, will soon be cut off. And so I guess the logic of it is, unless there's a renewed deal with the rest of Europe fairly soon, and it's unclear that there will be, then this has set Greece on a path to exiting the euro.
Eurozone nations are to hold a summit on Tuesday. What might they discuss?
I think European countries will discuss whether they should re-enter negotiations with Greece and what those negotiations might lead to. Obviously, those negotiations broke down over a week ago ahead of the referendum. And now, of course, whilst the Greeks are sort of saying that now they've got this no vote that will support their case against the creditors and lead to a better deal for Greece, the creditors, i.e. the European nations generally and, of course, the IMF, will probably stand fairly fast in terms of their requirements. So I think the European leaders will basically discuss what to do next, but it's not at all clear that they're going to want to enter into renewed negotiations with a government that they've found increasingly hard to deal with.
The commentators that I've heard indicate that Prime Minister Tsipras wants to remain in Europe, but not with the austerity measures that are expected to be imposed. Is that possible?
I think anything's possible here, and there's no doubt that the rest of Europe would prefer that Greece remains in the euro, but there's a price to be paid for that, and of course the rest of Europe doesn't want to be seen to be bending over backwards to Greece to allow them to stay without undertaking austerity, because that would send a wrong signal to other countries that might be vulnerable as well. So my feeling is that the Greek Prime Minister, to some degree, is being a bit disingenuous with his own population here. The population in Greece wants to stay in the euro, but, of course, to achieve that and to get support from the rest of Europe, they really need to show that they're keen on reforming their economy and undergoing the necessary austerity to cut back the size of government. But the no vote suggests that that's not the case. So, of course, it leaves us with a bit of a standoff here. On the one hand, Greece hoping for another deal, but the Europeans probably likely to balk at that.
And Shane Oliver, Chief Economist, Head of Investment Strategy at AMP Capital, that's in Sydney. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beattie. And now we're joined by G. Abby Lee for a look at what's being said about the Greek referendum on social media. Hello, G.
Hi, Steve. While we're busy celebrating the 4th of July here in America, Greek voters were casting their ballots on whether their government should accept the bailout terms. The social media analytics website Topsy shows that hashtag Greek referendum was tweeted around 100,000 times in the last 24 hours. But a more popular hashtag is hashtag Greferendum, which is a combination of the words Greece and referendum. That's been tweeted more than 187,000 times in the same period. One of the most famous personalities who used that hashtag is Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post. It's a US-based online news aggregator co-founded by Huffington. She's also its editor-in-chief. Her tweet was rather sarcastic. She wrote, "So apparently, if you want to influence a vote, condescension and contempt don't work. Who knew?" and added hashtag Greferendum. That's been retweeted more than 300 times, and just as many people marked it as a favorite. She also shared a New York Times article featuring a quote by renowned Greek poet Titos Patrikios, which read, "I suffer from one illness, and that is incurable optimism." She's on Twitter at Arianna Huff.
And how much clout does she have on Twitter?
A lot. She has more than 2 million followers and is quite prolific on Twitter.
So she's a big player in both the media industry and also the social media. But is there a particular reason why she's been tweeting about Greece so often?
Absolutely. The 64-year-old was born in the Greek capital city of Athens and is a naturalized American citizen. She was once married to former Republican Congressman Michael Huffington and kept his last name. The couple got divorced in 1997, and a year after that, her ex-husband came out of the closet. She's been doing quite well since then. She ran as an independent candidate for California's governor in 2003, for example. And last year, The Forbes magazine named her as the 52nd most powerful woman in the world. Not a shabby title, if you ask me. Steve?
Many thanks, G. That is quite interesting. VOA's G. Abby Lee. You know, if you find yourself on Twitter and would like to follow G, she can be found at G. Abby Lee. Also, we have a new Twitter site for VOA's International Edition. Hope you'll check us out. On Twitter, our handle is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. The deadline for Iran nuclear talks is quickly approaching as foreign ministers from the six negotiating powers and Iran meet in Vienna for a final push to reach a comprehensive agreement that limits Tehran's nuclear capabilities and, in exchange for that, the lifting of sanctions. We get more now from VOA's Mary Alice Salinas in Vienna.
As foreign ministers returned to Vienna, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry delivered a clear message about the status of Iran nuclear talks.
At this point, this negotiation could go either way.
Media gathered outside the Coburg Palace, where foreign ministers from the six negotiating powers will make a final push to secure a nuclear deal with Iran. While top diplomats with Iran and the so-called P5 plus one nations report progress, they face a formidable job as the July 7 deadline draws near.
But I want to be absolutely clear with everybody. We are not yet where we need to be on several of the most difficult issues.
The U.S. diplomat's message stood in contrast to a video recorded by Foreign Minister Zarif at the Coburg Palace and released on YouTube Thursday.
At this 11th hour, despite some differences that remain, we have never been closer to a lasting outcome.
Progress has been reported in two key areas, the pace of sanctions relief and a probe into whether Tehran's nuclear activities in the past have involved the development of technology to produce nuclear weapons. Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, Vienna.
And any deal with Iran would still have to be considered by the U.S. Congress. My colleague Jim Stevenson speaks with VOA congressional correspondent Michael Bowman about that part of the story.
The big question is, if there is a deal, what then? And it turns out that there would be some potential additional hurdles that any nuclear agreement would have to clear here in Washington. But there could be a sticking point in the U.S. Congress. It's not a treaty. It wouldn't be a treaty, which would require formal ratification and a two-thirds Senate vote.
Right.
But Congress did want to assert itself. And earlier this year, Congress passed a bill setting up majority, simple majority votes in both houses of Congress after a 30-day review period of any deal that might emerge from Vienna. And this was signed into law by President Obama. So this is something that has been set up. This has been cleared. And there was real concern initially from the Obama administration that this was untenable, that this would in effect give Congress veto power over something that the entire international community has been thirsting for lo these many years.
And there was talk that Congress could overturn a deal if a new president came into office. I suspect that was some Republican rhetoric going on.
Well, indeed. There's a Republican senator by the name of Tom Cotton. He's brand new to the Senate. He's a freshman. He wrote a letter, an open letter, earlier this year to Iran saying that under the U.S. Constitution, the president is not the king, and that any executive agreement can be undone by any administration that follows. And he did it in a somewhat condescending tone. He had these lines in there about, let me teach you about our form of government and our democracy and our Constitution. In fact, Tom Cotton was just on U.S. television just a few hours ago, and he said, look, this is a mistake, that Iran is a terrorism-sponsoring nation and that we have no business trying to negotiate away the leverage that we have as a result of these sanctions that have been enforced against Iran and which Iran very much wishes to see removed.
And it comes down to whether or not they actually get a deal. We've seen it, the deadline pass once before, and who knows? I mean, this could pass and Congress doesn't have anything to consider.
That is true, although there is some thought in Washington that the Obama administration has put so much on the line, so much of its prestige, so much of Obama's legacy on the line with this diplomatic initiative that it would be very difficult for the administration to walk away. Now, President Obama insisted just a few days ago, no, if it's a bad deal, I will walk away. We won't take it. But there is some thought in Washington that there has been such an expenditure of resources and time and effort and prestige that the administration would find it very difficult to walk away, despite what President Obama says.
Well, we enjoy every Monday when you walk to us and bring us a great topic. Thank you so much, Michael Bowman. He's our correspondent in the U.S. Senate.
Thank you, Jim.
And many thanks to Jim and Michael for what they shared with us there. Also in the news, the United States has pledged its support for Nigeria after days of insurgent attacks blamed on the Islamist group Boko Haram. U.S. spokesman John Kirby Sunday strongly condemned recent attacks that have killed dozens in the country's northeast and said the U.S. will support Nigerian efforts to bring those responsible to justice. In central Nigeria, late Sunday, two blasts rocked the city of Jos with an undetermined number of casualties. Jos was the scene of a deadly twin bombing, you might remember, back in February that left at least 17 people dead. Earlier on Sunday in Potiskum in northeast Yobe State, a suicide bomber detonated explosives inside of a Christian church, killing at least five. That capped a deadly week in Nigeria in which nearly 150 people were killed by the gunman in Borno State towns of Kukawa, that's near Lake Chad, and also the town of Monguno. South Sudan is expressing doubt about those UN negotiations, the allegations, that is, of atrocities committed by members of the army known as the Sudan People's Liberation Army, or SPLA. Colonel Philip Aguirre was responding to a report based on dozens of interviews accusing soldiers of raping and burning women and girls alive in oil-rich Unity State between April and June. Aguirre questions the veracity of the report, calling it politically motivated. He says if it is a reality, it has to be followed by transparent investigation, including the UN mission in South Sudan. UNMISS and other stakeholders prove the allegations are true. Aguirre says he suspects many of those interviewed are supporters of the rebel leader, Riek Machar. He says the army has taken steps to ensure soldiers fighting on behalf of the government don't commit human rights violations. That 18-month conflict between the government and the rebels loyal to Machar has left tens of thousands dead, displaced an estimated 3 million people. East African regional heads of state plan to meet in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, today to discuss the crisis in Burundi. It's unclear if embattled Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza, seeking a controversial third term, will attend. Meanwhile, the ruling party has rejected the mediation effort of UN envoy Abdullah Bathily of Senegal after he described last week's parliamentary election as not free and credible. It was boycotted by the opposition. A government spokesman Sunday insisted the diplomat lacked some neutrality in all of this, and the ballot was transparent, free, fair, and credible, and held in peace and security. Bathily is the second UN diplomat sent to mediate the crisis. UN envoy Said Djinnit, an Algerian diplomat, stepped down in June after being branded as too pro-government by civil society activists. Burundi plans to hold a presidential election later this month, July 15th, despite calls by the international community for a postponement, citing the security challenges that have forced 140,000 people to flee the country and left more than 70 dead in the streets. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
When someone dies, one of the key questions medical examiners or forensics experts try to answer is the exact time of death. Sometimes the examiners, especially those involved in criminal investigation, need to determine the time of death of someone who has been deceased for a while. Unfortunately, current technology really doesn't provide any reliable way of determining time of death if the person has been dead for more than 36 hours. But a group of researchers at Austria's University of Salzburg say that they've developed a new method for calculating this, even if the subject has been dead for as long as 10 days. To develop the new calculation, the researchers studied dead pigs and observed how much muscle proteins and enzymes decomposed over a period of time. They found that some of the proteins showed no signs of degradation until after 10 days. By studying the appearance of these signs, the researchers were able to determine the exact time of death. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. The career of British singer Amy Winehouse spanned less than a decade, and with her untimely death, was seemingly over in just a blink of an eye. Her entire life is chronicled in a new documentary film, as we hear from VOA's David Byrd, who gets things started with a Winehouse tune.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine.
Amy Winehouse died 4 years ago this month, but the new documentary Amy by award-winning director Asif Kapadia takes audiences behind the tragic story to meet the real Amy Winehouse. As he did with the acclaimed documentary Senna about the late Formula One champion Ayrton Senna, Kapadia uses no narration, only the words of the singer, her family, her friends, and those around her. Home videos, news reports, and performances show the singer from her childhood until her death at age 27.
I'm not a girl trying to be a star or trying to be anything other than a musician.
How big do you think you're going to be?
I don't think I'm going to be at all famous. I don't think I could handle it. I would probably go mad, you know what I mean? I would go mad.
Kapadia says the interviews with those around Winehouse paint a picture of a girl who loved making music but was also deeply troubled.
I hope people will see the real Amy, as all of her friends called her. Young Amy, really funny, really intelligent, bright-eyed, really beautiful and happy, amazingly creative. And then also, as the story gets darker, I hope people will kind of think about, you know, what happened and how it happened, and maybe a little bit about how I think everyone was slightly complicit.
Producer James Gay Reese says that as he and Kapadia researched the story, they began to unravel all the forces that tugged at Winehouse, and he thinks their portrayal of her shows the real woman.
And a lot of people who are very close to her say, you know, we have managed to kind of nail the real her. And that's the most important thing, is that people remember her for the lovely, brilliant person that she was, because she wasn't just some cartoon character that could be vilified in the press. And hopefully, I think what's happening is a lot of people are re-evaluating her. And, you know, because people like her don't come around very often, and we need to look after them.
Several people featured in the film attended its premiere, including Winehouse's former manager, Nick Szymanski, who said the movie shows the singer's extraordinary talent.
She was able to kind of sing jazz, sing R&B, have a killer voice, but she also had like a really modern perspective on stuff. And lyrically, she was as witty and as sharp as the best hip-hop rappers, you know, in terms of her writing and her lyrical ability.
Her parents' divorce when Amy was 9 is cited as a turning point in her life. Winehouse's family, particularly her father Mitch, has criticized the film for being inaccurate.
And I'm not just fighting for me, I'm fighting for Amy, because this is not the film that Amy would have wanted. You know, she would want her true friends to be recognized, which they're not. She'd want the man she was going to be married to be mentioned in the film, which he's not. She'd want me not to be portrayed in this light, because she knows what we all went through.
Asif Kapadia says that he has heard the family's criticism, but in the end, the film is not about them. It's about Amy.
No, you can't keep everybody happy. But what I will say is the vast majority of people who knew her well, who've seen the movie, really like it. And quite frankly, the movie's not about Reg, it's not about Mitch, it's about Amy. And I deny anybody to tell me that she doesn't come out of the movie brilliantly, because she does. She comes out of it fantastically. And it's a much more organic whole representation of who she was.
Amy is rated R for language and drug material. I'm David Byrd.
And many thanks to you, David. Well, listen to this, guys. U.S. Women's National Soccer Team has secured its third World Cup title with a 5-2 demolition of the 2011 champions, Japan. That was the Sunday title match up in Vancouver, Canada. Carly Lloyd scored a 3-goal hat trick in the opening 16 minutes, can you believe it, to put the game out of reach of the Japanese, who beat the United States in the final 4 years ago. Well, hundreds of U.S. supporters gathered here in Washington to watch the final, and VOA's Michael Lippin was with them. Michael, what was it like?
Well, Steve, it was incredible. I was with the main U.S. soccer supporters group, the American Outlaws, who packed the Laughing Man Tavern Bar in downtown D.C. You know, it was their best attended watch party of the tournament. And after the victory, I joined them for a celebratory march to the White House just a few blocks away. And that's where I spoke to the head of the D.C. chapter of the American Outlaws, Donald Wine, and asked him how he was feeling.
It's awesome. Like, the women work so hard, and, you know, just to see the show of support that everybody's been, you know, giving them over the last month, over the last couple years, actually, has been great. And, you know, the fact that they're able to cap off a lot of these players, it's their last World Cup. And for them to go out on top, perfect.
And what do you think this means for soccer in America?
Well, it's just one more title we can hang over the rest of the world and say, hey, look what we did in your own game. We got you. But, yeah, I mean, it's great for the game. It's great for the women's sport, obviously. And I know they've gained a lot of new fans over this cycle, and that's awesome.
And what about the men? When is it going to be their turn, do you think?
Well, hopefully 2018. But, you know, they're almost there. Like, we're, you know, one play away. If we get further than we were in the last tournament, 2014, which we did, you know, very good, who knows what we can do? I mean, with that American spirit, we can do anything.
Now, I also met outside the White House with two 26-year-old women who dressed to impress in the stars and stripes of the U.S. flag, Laura Neff from Los Angeles and Kaylee Wessling from Wyoming. I first asked Laura what she thought about the support the U.S. women have been getting.
I think it's just awesome that people are coming out to support women's sports. You know, like, I feel like people are really excited about men's soccer, and last year everyone was, like, all about it, and...
Yeah, I'm really, really proud of how much people supported. I was really disheartened at first because I felt like I didn't see as many people coming out for it, but they changed my mind by the end, and everyone's been cheering.
What do you think is in store for this sport in the country? Like, what about the men, for example? How do you think they're going to do going forward?
Well, so I was in Brazil last year for the World Cup, and yeah, it was heartbreaking seeing them lose, and I think that maybe having the women win this year, people are going to get more behind it and get more into soccer in general. I think that's where our country's headed, is getting more into soccer in general.
And you know, the U.S. men will get their chance to prove themselves in just 2 days from now when they start their campaign for the Gold Cup. That is the North and Central American Regional Tournament, Steve.
And many thanks to you, VOA's Michael Libin, out having some fun and telling us all
about
it.
Lots of fun.
Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to The Voice of America. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday. Did it to it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While there's been much encouraging news about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in recent months, new infections of the virus continue, and the United States remains committed to doing what it takes to stop them. U.S. Ebola treatment units and basic response infrastructure are in place, and thousands of U.S.-supported civilian responders are at work to fight the disease. It's killed more than 11,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and a handful of other countries, including our own. Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, but is still within a 90-day period on heightened security for recurrence of the disease. New cases continue to emerge elsewhere, with 8 recently identified in Sierra Leone and 12 in Guinea. Cases continue in areas bordering Guinea-Bissau, and efforts to ensure that country is better prepared for Ebola cases are underway. The U.S. National Institutes of Health is conducting trials on various candidate Ebola vaccines, including a controlled trial on the effectiveness of one vaccine in particular. NIH is also testing therapeutic drug candidates to treat those who have been infected, working to improve diagnosis of the disease, which has so far required sophisticated, labor-intensive DNA analysis, and trying to better understand how it causes the disease. In other words, the United States is supporting a wide range of research on prevention and treatment of Ebola. Meanwhile, a partnership between U.S. and Liberian researchers is studying approximately 7,500 people in that country, including 1,500 who survived Ebola within the last 2 years. Health investigators want to better understand Ebola's long-term health consequences and determine if survivors develop long-term immunity that will protect them from future infection. They also would like to better understand how the Ebola virus can persist in some organs of survivors long after they appear to have recovered, and the degree of risk that they can transmit the virus to others. While we have succeeded in controlling the exponential growth of the disease, getting to zero cases will require a sustained international response. The fight is far from over, and we remain committed to achieving an Ebola-free West Africa. The research U.S. and other scientists are carrying out now will improve the odds of preventing any future outbreak of Ebola from spreading, as the 2014 epidemic did.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
It's 4 hours.